I'm Tyler Smith.
And I'm Alexandria Hadara. Welcome to Global Takes, America's number one podcast discussing global issues from the Black perspective.
It's time for our voices to be at the forefront of foreign politics and innovation. This is Global Takes.
When you are an expat, the people that you meet along the way, they become your extended family. It could be glorious.
In Taiwan, we made new friends, unexpected situations that only made us stronger, and unforgettable moments filled with joy and love. Our journey as expats has only just begun.
Today on Global Take, we're going to talk to Mrs. Juanita Ingram. She is the hit producer of the new reality show, International Ingram, that's featured on Amazon Prime. We're going to talk about the role of Black film in foreign policy, the role of Black films in terms of how Black people are treated abroad. Get ready for this discussion.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for that wonderful, wonderful, warm welcome. My early childhood years, I'm from Chattanooga, Tennessee, originally. My parents, my mother in particular, got me into the arts very early. My mother is a musician. She's a music and choral teacher, certified teacher and director, and has been a music composer for years. She's been 32 years actually in the public school system teaching music and voice. And so she pushed me into theater. I want to say when I was 9 was the first time that I performed on stage at the Tivoli Theater. Mm-hmm. And I just fell in love with the stage. I remember when it was over, and they were turning out the lights, and I remember standing on the edge of the stage just looking, and the theater was empty. And I don't know why, other than I was a quirky little kid, been doing quirky things. And so I just stood there, though. I remember thinking, this is the best thing ever. And usually when I have those moments, they're very rooting in the sense of, I don't know that at the time I was kind of rooting myself and this is going to be a path that I'm going to pursue. At the time, you knew it was time for us to move and live in London. And I don't think we would have been able to feel confident that we could have done that, but for those earlier experiences. And I don't feel that I would have been able to do that, but for my childhood experiences of really being pushed to grow and explore. So those early experiences really matter.
The idea of having like your own reality TV show, and it's quite unique because one, you don't see too many like Black successful families on a reality show unless there may be like major big celebrities, right. And then you have like, you know, this Housewives of Atlanta type of reality show, or Hip Hop in Atlanta. And it always portrayed Black women in the worst way, in the most of their stereotypical way.
There's nothing wrong with her putting it on Front Street to discuss it like grown women instead of these little side immature conversations being bitchy and catty.
Look, Claudia, you want to be the it girl, but you ain't got it. You got an eye, but you are definitely missing the T, boo. Proceed with caution.
Breaking ground. Can you tell us a little bit about your show and like how you came up with that idea and how was the pitching with Amazon and so forth?
Yes. Ooh. Girl, ooh, the pitch word is... It's triggering. My therapy session isn't until tomorrow. The idea of the show, when I moved to London, I started getting back into acting. I just I went and got an agent, got signed, started acting again, and then we lived in London for almost 5 years, and we had to move back to the U.S. And in that time, while I was in London, I picked up some clients. I had my own private practice, and I've always been a transactional attorney, business attorney, and, you know, film is a business. And so I had some clients who were in the reality space and negotiating their contracts and reviewing their deals and seeing the process, being on set with them. That was one thing that opened my eye to that particular genre, because film and television, you know, are so many genres within those two sectors. And the unscripted world is very different, similar in many ways, very different from scripted. And so I had experience in scripted television from a performer perspective, or scripted film, I should say. Well, television too, by the time I decided to get behind the camera. But while we were living in London, so that's how I got into the industry aspect of it, was really through representing clients within entertainment and then being an entertainer and an actress myself. But for the show, I will never forget. I was living in London. I was coming from Dress for Success, Greater London one day. I started that affiliate there. And I was coming from like trying to set up, and I was going to get my nails done in Brick Lane in this place. And I put my keychain down, and the lady, she was a Black British lady. And she looked at my keychain, and at that time there was a reality show out about Black sorority life. And it was only on for one season. But she lit into me. She was like, "Why do you all behave? Oh, you're in that organization. Why do you all behave that way? Why are you cursing and fighting on television? You're making all Black women look bad. You're supposed to be college educated women. This is a Black British woman." She just went in. And I was like, first of all, I'm not on the show. Okay, that's first. Second of all, whoa. But most importantly, because I was just like, I really just came in for a fill-in. But I was like, when I noticed that and that impact that these shows who are in syndication and are seen all over the world, they have a way of influencing how we are handled and oftentimes mishandled in the entire world globally. And I just thought, as most people, you know, when you think of reality TV, especially for Black people, you think, you look at it through a US lens, or you think of it from a United States perspective, because that's normally either where you're viewing it from, where it's filmed. I don't think there's been an international reality show for African Americans. To your point, it's usually we only get shows if we are celebrities already. They only depict Black success being rappers or athletes. If it is a common person or unknown person, it is usually depicting us in a very stereotypical way that does impact. From my experience, I'm not telling you what I believe or what I think. I'm telling you from going all over the globe. Because when we were living in London, our kids saw 23 countries. I've been all up and through Europe. I've been all up and through Asia. You know, I've been in so many different spaces and seen the impact that scripted and unscripted, because it's two different things. When you get into positive images of Black people on television, you usually have to go to scripted. That's when you go to the Cosby Show, Different Worlds, Blackish, Insecure. Yeah. You know, you get scripted television and fictional characters. But when you really look at unscripted television, it is very rare. I mean, I look at RuPaul's Drag Race gives us positive images. It's funny and it's interesting. And there's still a little bit of, I don't know, LGBTQAI+ pain that is on display there. Because every time you get I'm not going to talk about that because I'm not in that space, but I have friends who are people that I love who are. And the same, I'll keep it to myself, same analogy with Black people. Black pain being the main catalyst, you know, and then what I call the formula for negative drama. And I'm not putting down any particular show because I love them all. I think, honestly, you have to be a fan of whatever genre you're in, or not even a fan, but a real true student. And so I have to watch everything because it's an art form to actually putting together a show. You all just feel that it's positive, it's cool, but it's a form to creating stories the same way it is for unscripted television or for scripted television. There's a formula and a way to put together unscripted. But when you look at the impact and the imagery and putting forth things that not only challenge stereotypes but break them, we don't get that as Black people. You know, you can get Chris Lee Knows Best, and they can get that all day long. And I'm a big fan of Chris Lee Knows Best from a show perspective because it's very family friendly. It normalizes there. It's just white people being. I still can't figure out what Chris Lee does. I mean, in terms of like He wasn't a celebrity. We're well known. Mm-hmm. But when you get into shows for us, we either have to be athletes or the wives of athletes. Mm-hmm. We have to be rappers or entertainers. And that is the only way that we get our definition and ability to be successful. Mm-hmm. But what about the everyday person that's working really hard, went to college, made some right choices, managing companies? I got the idea for the show too, not only from that experience, but we used to do Soul Food Sunday in London. So mm-hmm. I don't know how I attract all the black people living where I go, but I do. I just run into them.
It is nice because you kind of yearn from that. I think living over you do yearn for your own community. And I mean, I integrate with like the larger American community, but you know, there's just certain cultural nuances that you just don't get unless it's with your people, so to speak.
Absolutely. You look for your tribe.
Yeah.
You know, and we used to do Soul Food Sunday in London, and we were rotating from house to house, and one day we were celebrating this family that got a promotion. They were going back. It was like 35 of us. Frankie Beverly and Maze and Beyonce was playing. We were barbecuing on the lawn. Kids were running around. It really could have been any neighborhood, any city, any town in America. But I looked up in the background, and there was Windsor Castle. Because we lived in the Windsor Ascot area. And then I looked around, and every person there was a director, a vice president, you know, a GM of affiliate. And then we were all black. And I knew that that had never been shown in terms of black excellence and normalizing us in international spaces, normalizing black success from a professional perspective, from normal everyday people who are living internationally, and just showing us normal black folk in these amazing spaces and what those experiences are like. And as a filmmaker, storyteller, you always want to do something that's different, that hasn't been shown, that hasn't been told. I didn't know how triggering our show would have been to white people. I've gotten some interesting experiences.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. I should have put a trigger warning in the beginning, like, you don't like seeing, you know, happy, normalized, possibly affluent black people. You know, the whole luxury side of our show really this like triggered.
I know you are a diva. You are just.
Oh, thank you. I like what I like. Oh, thank you. You know, I like what I like. And I didn't know because I made the show. You know, you always have your target audience in mind. I made the show for everybody, about us, though. And mm-hmm. I didn't really make the show for sensitive white women who didn't like to see black women have luxury and black women have a spouse that loves them. You know, I think for black women, we are the proverbial mammies of the world until you infuse our womanhood in it. And then we are constantly, for decades now, ain't I a woman? Mm-hmm. And so to see black women be able to be multidimensional and to see us be mothers and cared for and loved and successful and divas and like sequence and sparkle and be cute and not just to center us in black pain. It is okay if you see us struggling. We can't keep a man. You know, we can't keep a job. We look a little, you know, pedestrian and dusty. We can be the mammies of the world. We can save elections. We can save, you know, we can save society.
Wow. Mammies of the world.
The proverbial mammy of the world is okay as long as I'm nursing someone else's dream, be it a wet nurse on the plantation or the proverbial nurse of the nation. It is okay. But as soon as I am a woman with my own luxuries, with my own preferences, with my own life, my own children, my own husband, my own profession, my own business, my own joy. The luxury of life in that show is the joy and the journey to joy. But we have to normalize that. Someone asked me one time, do you really have to normalize black people in international spaces? The person that was asking me that was British. They were from London. I'm like, yes, it's the norm to you.
Yeah, because
nobody in London.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of that, like with black films, I mean, do you see they play an image abroad? Like they play an image in terms of like, you know, promoting these positive images of black culture, black people? Because I just don't see a lot of black. When I lived in Rwanda, we did have Black Panther. That was huge. It was like a whole production and like after party of the movie. Mm-hmm. Like there was a whole promotion. It was so cool to be in Africa to watch that film. But I didn't see Fences. Fences came out. I had to wait to get streamed. I didn't see a lot of like really critical Black films that I couldn't watch. And if you don't have, the internet was so slow, streaming was really hard. So just want to get your take on like just the Black film industry. Like, what are you seeing being in the industry? Like, what are the, what's the trend going?
Yeah, you know, there was a wonderful report, the McKinsey report that came out that really, really broke this down, because Black Panther did a lot for us as people and for the industry, because it proved that we were bankable. You know, there's about $10 billion that they're leaving, the industry leaves on the table every year, and not catering to more Black film, and not just Black film, because sometimes what they cater to centers in Black pain. And we are tired of just being a struggle. And so a lot of times what you see is us as a struggle, not us as a people, not us as human. I think Black Panther was phenomenal. And I loved seeing the impact of that, because it was everywhere versus, but that again, you got to go to scripted to see us in validated spaces, to see us and to really get us on an international level. International distribution of other films is very limited. And in the Asian continent, it's interesting, because I remember when I first moved to Taiwan, my acting coach is in China. And one of my acting coaches is in China. And I have one that's in Atlanta, one that's in China. And she was like, "You're so talented. I really want your show to do well." Basically, she was like, "I want your show to do well so you can become more popular, so I can put you on more casting calls because you're such a talented actress." But she put me in contact with the largest distribution media company in Taiwan. The CEO just happened to be her best friend. And her best friend put me in contact with a small group that said, he was like, "I want you to take care of her. I want you to help her with whatever she needs." And I thought, look at God, this is great. So I meet with these people, and they're all Taiwanese, and one has an interpreter. Two of them speak English, they're interpreting for him. And I was talking about my show and possibly pitching to Netflix. Is there a Netflix Asia? Because I'm like, you know, can you help? And they made every excuse to not help. And then he finally said to me, "Taiwanese people don't want to see Black people on TV. I really don't think there's an audience for Black shows within Asia. No one's going to be interested in that."
Wow.
And especially not reality TV. He was like, you know, maybe cartoons, maybe something like Black Panther, but not this. And I still think he was wrong, because we had a great reception, but for the most part, because they haven't seen it. And what they will get is Black Panther, but we're not all fantasy characters. We're not all superheroes. What about the day-to-day average person that normalizes us in their space? And that's the continued journey. That's where the work still has to be done, because when that occurs, you get situations where, you know, this is how you get situations where COVID first happened and you had people of African descent in China being mishandled and thrown out into the street. And, you know, they're mistreated because they have one particular idea of us. In season two of my show, we focus more on like interracial couples and dating internationally, things that my family couldn't bring to the show. I wanted to really expand and give other expats, although we had five other groups and five other Black expats on the show, and even white expats on the show in the season one. I really wanted to open it up to more of a diverse demographic, still through our lens, but we have one couple, the husband's from Atlanta, the wife is Taiwanese, they have a beautiful little girl, and I won't give away too much of season two, but their experience of raising a biracial child. Now, to me, if you hadn't told me that she was mixed, I would have never assumed that the baby was anything other than Taiwanese. But that little girl has been through being called too dark, ugly, all kinds of things. And then we got into what they actually teach them about Black people in the school system.
Mm. Oh, really? There.
And it was interesting. I won't give it away, but it's really interesting, the stereotypes that start very young. And I asked, why is that? And television was the first thing that came up. The images that they see in films, the images that they were like, it's always a gangster, it's always somebody bad. And these are the things that they still see, because you don't get a lot of shows that have international distribution.
Oh, just so I guess the Blackish and the Bill Cosby show, those have international. Even those shows are not everywhere. Even the Blackish.
Those shows are not everywhere. I've never seen Blackish in Asia. I've never seen it. If, like I said, you could stream it. You know, you have to stream it. But if in terms of actually, someone asked, well, is your show on cable in Taiwan? And I'm like, no. And I have Mandarin subtitles. It's not, you know, my pitch documents are in Mandarin. I have tried, and everyone that's watched the show has been super supportive, super open. I do think that gentleman represented a particular generation also. He was about maybe 10, 15 years older than me. So sort of in a baby boomer generation. I think that it's very hard because what they have seen from us is very limited in terms of these images that are put forth to them in entertainment. So I think in the entertainment space, it's very powerful in how we are handled and oftentimes mishandled on a global scale.
So just being in the Hollywood industry, do you feel like, I guess, are Black filmmakers, are they trying to make inroads in it, international? Yeah. And are they, you feel like they do kind of influence like U.S. foreign policy, like films like Hotel Rwanda? That wasn't a Black film per se, but it told a Black story, or Blood Diamonds. Like, do you see these Black films kind of like influencing our foreign policy? Or
I definitely do. I mean, it's one thing about, and again, I go back to scripted television and film. Oftentimes they're reflective. They're telling a story of like what happened in Hotel Rwanda. That it told what happened. Hopefully it influences policy, but it's telling what happened, and it seems distant, and we can still put ourselves at arm's length and say, well, that was history. You know, same thing with Selma. Same thing with the Exonerated Five, the Central Park Five. You're telling about what happened, but at the time there was nothing to tell about what was happening. And that's what I think there's a difference between. Again, I think in the minds of people, you're talking about international audience, foreign policy, sure, and getting truth out and shining a flashlight on things that impact policy, absolutely. In terms of shining and illuminating light on us as people and how we are handled internationally as people, when they look at scripted shows, it's fantasy. So even if they were to see Blackish or to see maybe the Cosby show, you know, and even when Cosby came out, it was always, that's not relatable. That's not real Black people. You know, this is a scripted television show. That's not how really Black people are. That's not how real Black people behave. But then you get an entire genre of unscripted television that gives them a particular lens of Black people. And not that we aren't all of those things, but we are not a monolith. And on the continuum of us being, do we get upset and flip tables and cut it out? Sometimes, maybe, you know, it happens. It happens with everybody. But the problem comes when you only show one side of an entire group of people repetitively. And you never get to. And you never get to see the other side of the continuum. Because we are not a monolith. We do different things. Success looks different for us. But if you put forth to young people, well, the only way you're really going to be successful is if you are a rapper or, you know, an athlete, then we feel subconsciously take that message on. Like, well, everybody wants to be that. And if you're not that, you're nothing. Or we don't really show the real options that we have. And then to people who are watching, and this particular couple in my show, that their in-laws, their Taiwanese in-laws were thinking a particular way about a person. and they were influenced by what they saw on television. And
I mean, I knew Black weren't really, like, Black films weren't really showed abroad, but I didn't think in Asia in particularly, it was the films and the movies that kind of, like, shaped their viewpoints of Black people abroad. So there's a lot of work to do with that. I guess just kind of want to get you, so speaking of that, like, I know, like, during the height of the George Floyd protests in the summer of 2020, there was, like, a lot of protests going on, and I even saw some clips with you and your daughter, and I just thought about myself and my kids protesting in the D.C. area. So I just kind of know, like, what were you doing that time, and what was the coverage like in Singapore of the Black Lives Matter movement, and do you see, like, were you involved, or are you trying to use your platform to raise awareness on these issues?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, at the time we were living in Taiwan, mm-hmm. and we were filming, and that's how I ended up, you know, capturing. We had a peace rally in Taiwan, as many places did all over the world, and it was powerful. One of our key cast members from season one and season two was the organizer of the Black Lives Matter rally in Taiwan Toy, and from that spawned a host of other events from Taipei Is Listening. Taipei is a city that we lived in, so Taipei Is Listening, which was also on the show, was where we really had these community conversations. You know, it was like 400 people that showed up, mainly Taiwanese. Even at the rally, maybe 500 or 600 people out there, majority Taiwanese. That is where I found the rest of the Black people. I didn't know there were many Black people in Taiwan. I hit that corner and I'm like, oh, so y'all are here. Yeah, ooh, everybody's here. You know, everybody and mama's here. But the experience, and I say this all the time, while you cannot outrun racism, because racism is everywhere, bigotry is everywhere, because people are people. I think living abroad helps you to experience it differently. And there are microaggressions that I still experience in Asia, both in Taiwan and Singapore. That's just the reality of life. However, it is non-threatening. I'm not going to die. Nobody's going to put their hands on me. Nobody's going to attack me. And it was interesting at our rally to see the police helping set up, to see the police helping take down. They were there to be helpful. They were passing out water. You know, they were just really super, super supportive. And it was very peaceful, except for this one guy, which is in the show. You have to watch the show to see what happened to me. It was weird. It was bizarre. The energy there in the space was amazing. Super supportive. People wanted, it opened up the dialogue that people have been wanting to have. And I think especially with my generation, with Gen X, with millennials and Gen Zs, really coming together in these other spaces after the rally, mm-hmm. is where the real work was being done, and having these conversations about the microaggressions that we experience that, quite frankly, can still be exhausting. Now, they may not be life-threatening, but do I get tired when I was in Taiwan of getting on the elevator and everyone jumping when they saw me? Yes, it gets a little, because I know you've seen Black Panther, and I know you've seen Will Smith, you've seen somebody on TV, Denzel, somebody. So the idea and the concept, you know, you're not out in a...
That's interesting.
It is a fantasy, but when you see it, when you see one in real life, you know, it's, whoa, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm like, oh, sorry. You know, they let me out today and I'm here, you know, but it is interesting. Yes, to the point, it's a fantasy, but it's not real. And the danger, I think, of not having us represented in a positive, balanced manner, because I'm not saying take away anybody else's show. It's just about being balanced. That's all about showing the full breadth of us. Mm-hmm. The danger of that is that you remove our full humanity. Mm-hmm. And when you remove a person's full humanity, that's how you get a situation where someone can put their knee down on someone's neck to the point where they die because you don't see them as human. And everyone in that police squad stand around and look at someone dying. And you don't see that as death of a human because you removed our humanity. And so the arts have always played an integral and a pivotal part in influencing the world. It was always the arts where you could talk about things, be it infusing comedy, or be it just being bold and brazen in a manner that the rest of the world was not ready to deal with that issue, but for the depiction through something that they could help them to interpret, help them to digest. That's mm-hmm. always, whether it be poetry, spoken word, music, paintings, always social issues. The catalyst of change has been through film, television, other performance, dance, interpretive. We were always there to help yeah. society move and help them with issues. And so I think, the problem with not showing us in a balanced depiction in any genre is that everyone else gets to be human, but you're not normalizing our humanity, because mm-hmm. humans are balanced. Humans have full spectrum. Humans are multidimensional. But if we aren't allowed to see that, others aren't allowed to see that, then we become foreign. We become different. And like, we aren't different.
Almost.
Like aliens, almost.
Interesting. Like, I know, like, mm-hmm. with the Rolling Stone, they had a reporter, like, going back to George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery. So those were, like, the two big cases that kind of sparked the whole Black Lives Matter movement. And, like, what has been the international reaction of those cases? And mm-hmm. How do you see that as, like, do you see people saying, oh, United States is fully democratic, there's a democratic country, there's a justice system, and things are going to be fair? Or are people kind of being critical, like, oh, you know, wow, you know, he was in the case of George Floyd, they wanted him to get 30 years instead he got 22 and a half years, and yeah. they're still waiting on this Ahmaud Arbery. He can, and even with the Chauvin case, he can get off if he's there on good behavior in prison. Mm-hmm. So I'm just kind of curious to know, like, how does this undermine our democracy? Or, I mean, what's your point?
It undermines the democracy, and it's embarrassing, yeah. quite frankly. It is humiliating as an American living abroad, because we do claim to be a democracy. And the fact that we were all praying mm-hmm. so hard for the Ahmaud Arbery case to even get a conviction, and needed to pray, and had substantiated valid reasons and concerns as to why they might not get convicted because of mm-hmm. the system and the justice. And as a lawyer, you know, I tell people all the time, no, the justice system isn't always fair. Stay out of it. But as an American and an American attorney, it is concerning. It does undermine the idea we're a democracy for some, but not all. Justice for some, but not all, on an inconsistent basis. And people do look at that. And now it depends on where you are, because every place sees things differently. If I get into a taxi in London, the first thing they want, oh, you're from America. Gosh, awful what happened to George Floyd, isn't it? And I think it's a universal feeling of, this is horrible. You know, how could this happen? But you are also have to remember, we're looking at places like Taiwan, where police officers don't carry guns, or where the police, it would be very rare for the police to shoot anyone. Yeah, well, London, they don't carry guns in London either, unless they're protecting the Queen. So the issue of gun violence and the issue of the ability of a police officer to kill without responsibility, it's just really strange. Here in Singapore, I think I've seen the military. I don't know if I've seen a police officer. It's so rule-based, and there's so much compliance that, again, if there is a microaggression that occurs, I don't have no worry at all of myself, my children, my husband, anywhere in Asia, or in, I shouldn't say anywhere in Asia, in Taiwan or Singapore. I'll speak for the places I've lived, mm-hmm. And experiencing violence. Mm. And that's just not going to occur. But do I think, in Taiwan, there was an outpouring of support, an outpouring of, we need to have these conversations. How are we handling Black people in space?
Yeah, how do they, has it improved, or was this like a spark of consciousness?
I definitely think it was a spark of consciousness. Improved, you know, it's hard for me to be critical because of my lens that I'm looking at it through. Again, microaggressions are exhausting. They're you know, unhealthy, frustrating. but you're not going to die. They do mishandle us in global spaces often. In Taiwan, there was an outpouring of tremendous support, and there's a continuation of that. So Toy, in the show, you'll see that we had Taipei is listening, which I was blown away because I didn't expect that many people after the rally to come back and have these small groups. It was like 400 people that broke out into small groups and had real conversations about what it was like being in Black and in this space, what people needed to do to improve, how we needed to speak to one another. And important also in recognizing that Black people weren't the only ones that struggled as a marginalized people in the space. We really talked about the indigenous Taiwanese issues. They were at the rally because when you're in a global space, you can't just take up that space and act like your issue is the only issue that matters. And, you know, you really have to acknowledge that there are migrant workers that are also suffering from being marginalized, indigenous people of the land. And so that those groups coming together to solve larger issues of oppression.
Spark the minority oppression that's going on in their own country.
Yes, and you really have to respect their issues as well and come together and partner, and it's powerful. And so you see more of that even in season two, where Toy is heading up these things called community combos. And it happens for a season of maybe 10 to 12 weeks every week, where they're talking about different issues, be it race, be it policy, culture, current issues and laws. And we just filmed the planning session for the upcoming one that she's having on indigenous issues. And what does it mean to be indigenous? And we're talking about people who are there from, who are Haitian, who are indigenous Taiwanese, you know, to some of us who have indigenous backgrounds, you know, and being identified as indigenous versus identifying, you know. So it really sparked conversations that needed to be had. And when it came time on this season for the Stop Asian Hate March,
that's another question, but how did that take place? Mm-hmm. Like, did you
have to watch season two? I had to watch the show. We were there. Like, and it's an interesting conversation because while many of our Black counterparts in the U.S. were like, that's their problem, I'm not getting involved in that, because where were they during Black Lives Matter? We couldn't really say that, because during Black Lives Matter in Taiwan, they were all up and through. You know, it was a united front, and for many.
How it
played out internationally was very different.
Wow, the whole Asian, we definitely need to unite. Because I know with the Stop Asian Hate, I mean, at least they got some legislation out of their protests, and there hasn't been any. Like, so speaking of that, like, I know earlier you had been on Sky News and you were commenting about the Trump campaign, his political campaign when he was running for president, and now he's not. We have Biden, you know, we have our first Asian and Black VP, Kamala Harris, yet there hasn't been much movement on, like, the George Floyd Justice and the Policing Act, the John Lewis and Voting Act. So we got Juneteenth. So, but most Black people don't even celebrate that holiday, sadly. But I grew up celebrating 4th of July more so than Juneteenth.
Yeah, I think it depends on where you were in the country as to whether or not you really celebrated Juneteenth. I think Juneteenth has become more popular in the last couple of days as we recognize that other holidays aren't really for us. It wasn't really about us. You know, and so there's so much that needs to be done still. And our lens and our experience is just one, but from a policy perspective, I think the rest of the world is shocked that it is so stagnant as it relates to the rights and protections of African American people. Wow. It is shocking to them, and from in terms of what's happening in the U.S. And contrary to what many Americans believe, not everybody is pining to get over to America. Not everybody really just is like, oh, I'm longing to leave my country and go to America, the American dream. Some people are really happy where they are. And I think what they're seeing happen in America right now makes it so they're like, I'm going to put the Grand Canyon off to 2025. You know, like, not really trying to go there right now. And it is shaping how people really view. I mean, they love New York, you know, still love us as a country to come and visit. But seeing how people are being mishandled and how policy is stagnant as it relates to the protections that we have a right to. A little embarrassing, a little bit.
I mean, I didn't think about that. So, like, they're seeing, okay, we had this Black Lives Movement, or I guess, you know, these Black men were, you know, killed by police, they were attacked. We had the movement. We should have seen some legislation. We've seen what's happening in justice, in the criminal justice system. So,
Act to be passed in the future.
The George Floyd Justice and Policing Act passed the House within a month of his death, but is still bogged down in the Senate. It would ban chokeholds for federal agents, outlaw no-knock search warrants in federal drug cases, create a national database for tracking police misconduct, and remove qualified immunity from lawsuits.
But the reality is that for years now, quietly, silently, not getting a whole lot of press, but people are still being lynched in various places, drugged behind cars. You know, this is in the last 15, 10 years. That's not distant. Even in the last couple of years, mysteriously, people are in parks and discovering Black people hanging from trees and, you know, trying to rule it a suicide. Because when I'm, you know, I don't want to speak for those who are suicidal, but I don't know of many Black people who, even suffering with depression, decide, well, let me go hang myself from a tree. Maybe, I don't know, but I would like to see the stats on that. I think it's rare. But we have a long way to go. And the way it is viewed internationally is a little disappointing. I think last year we had a lot of, you know, during the Black Lives Matter movement, there was a whole lot of allies and solidarity. And a lot of that was spoken. And then I feel like we had a backlash from that. And people who may have run for Ahmaud would still turn around and try to persecute. I know one person, I'm not gonna get into it too much, but one person in particular that had real issues with the show, white woman. And you know, on her Facebook page, because, you know, the comments and then feedback that we get, and sometimes the attacks that are even behind the scene that nobody is ever going to see or hear about. You had one woman who was running for Ahmaud, but complaining about our show. It's too luxurious. It's too, and the luxury was me. So, you know, you will run again, center on Black pain. You think you're an ally. But we don't really need allies anymore. We need soldiers. We need people who are actually going to get into the trenches and do the work, not just put, you know, I ran for Ahmaud up on your Facebook page. But when it comes to seeing imagery that would have impacted possibly, you know, instead of him being run down and chased like a pig in a wild boar, hit with a car and murdered, as though he weren't human. But you have an issue with the arts and a show that is trying to infuse our humanity in a very real, non-scripted, non-fantasy, but an honest way. But you take issue with that because there's a difference between someone who just gives verbiage, oh, I want to be an ally, but allies give up a form of privilege. And that is
thank you for joining Global Take. That does it. I hope you got inspired, informed, and ready to change the world. Thank you for listening.